Welcome to Flowcast. I'm Sister Beth Murphy, the Flowcast producer and your host for this episode. We're exploring the rapidly changing media landscape and its impact on our lives as citizens and people of faith. With me today is my old friend, Sister Rose Picotti. Sister Rose is a member of the Daughters of St. Paul and the founding director of the Pauline Center for Media Studies. She's a film critic, author, and sought-after speaker on all things media and pop culture in the United States and around the world, actually. So welcome, Sister Rose.
Thank you, Beth. It's so nice to be here.
It's great to be with you. I think I heard that you're in Boston.
Right.
Is that correct? You're at the,
that is correct.
At the Mother House. And you usually hang your hat in Los Angeles.
That's right. And then for my 50th Jubilee last year, I asked to change countries for a year just to get a different perspective. And the Superior General said, come to Rome. So I went to Rome, and it was supposed to be until after the Synod so I could write about it. But my unfortunately, my right knee gave out, and I had to come back to the States to take care of that, to, you know, got to take care of business. And so, but I'm on my, God willing, I'm on my way back to Rome in November.
But that will be after the Synod is over, huh?
Right. But then remember, the Pope extended it for a year, so I'll be there next year. I've got a 2.5 year assignment, and it has to do with media literacy education, with starting an in-house program, an intra-congregational program.
How wonderful.
And you're the first to hear it really announced.
That is so wonderful. I'll be happy to break the news.
Yes.
So let's talk about that some more. We can back up a little bit.
Sure.
And because I think that's what you do in Los Angeles. You run the Pauline Center for Media Studies in LA. And maybe you could talk a little bit about what that is and what is the mission of the center.
Sure. Well, the mission of the Pauline Center for Media Studies is to study media and to mediate it for culture, for education, and faith formation. Basically, it's how we learn to think critically through media literacy education, just in the regular educational realm, or what we call media mindfulness in the faith community realm, because there we're really thinking of the whole person, and media literacy actually has, or media mindfulness, media literacy education actually is for the whole person. It's just not a cerebral activity, which I think the name gives it. You know, it kind of sounds hard, but it's really not. It's a lifestyle. It's a way of life, a way of thinking, an attitude, so that we learn to become mindful, critical thinkers as we engage in the media world around us. And everything is mediated for us. So the mediation that we do as content providers online, for example, we also need to be mindful in that regard, because we're not only consumers, as we were until 1995 when the internet came, right? Well, when it was commercialized. And then we all became creators, content creators, as well as consumers. So what does that mean for us, people who want to be decent, good human beings, but also people of faith?
Yes, and I love that you talk about we are mediators. And in a way, we always have been, correct?
Yes, I think so.
We mediate who we are through our bodies, first of all. We
Absolutely.
Are incarnate beings. And you know, and I know, that when people know us well, we can walk into a room and all they have to do is look at us to know our mood, to know how we're doing that day. Because our bodies say something. That's the nature of the incarnation. So I think what you're doing at the center is trying to help people integrate their use of media. And when we say that, we mean movies and books, but also texts and Facebook posts and
digital social media, the whole panorama, the whole universe of communication.
Right. So why is that important to us as Christians?
Well, I think because the media tell us who we are and who we ought to be. And we need to talk back to that. We need to resist. And by that, I don't mean violent resistance. What I mean is we need to push back. We need to question what the media says we should be or who we should be, what we should look like. You know, we women have been fighting the image that has been advertising has done to us, right, for decades now. And there's some excellent media literacy materials by Killing Us Softly by Jean. Her name is right at the tip of my tongue. But anyway, Killing Us Softly, 1, 2, 3, and 4. It's all about our image presented to us by the media. And then you have the Dove Foundation with Gina Davis, who's completely taking the other part of it and saying, let's look at who women and girls really are, not just who Photoshop makes them out to be, or now AI. On top of all of this, we have AI. And that's even more, well, there's some opportunities there, but certainly some bigger challenges because we can't tell what's real and what's not.
I wondered if we would get into that, and I'm glad you brought it up. So what would be an appropriate and wise approach for faithful people thinking about the use of artificial intelligence?
Well, I think even as good human beings and as people of faith, certainly what is motivating us to use it in the first place? So what I have found it an excellent brainstorming tool. So I will go into chat AI and I will put brainstorm this topic. And what are key 6 points that you would bring out in a meeting or a conference or a presentation on this topic? And it'll brainstorm wonderfully, but you have to check it because sometimes AI does what they call hallucinate. That's what they call it when it creates something because it thinks that it makes sense according to their algorithms and that this could be. You heard about the lawyer who was presenting a case or arguing a case in front of the Supreme Court a few months ago. I think it was in May, April or May. And he brought up case law that wasn't really case law at all. AI had hallucinated it. And when he questioned it after he got in trouble and called out by the judge, when he went back on and they said, well, we thought that it made sense. So wow. An algorithm or algorithms thought it made sense.
But that's not really an appropriate way to do law.
Absolutely not. And it's not an appropriate way to do homework. It's not an appropriate way to write a book. But I've heard that, you know, they're pumping out romance novels now with AI. Really? Are you that desperate? That's what I want to say.
And I think there are some positive uses of it. You mentioned brainstorming. I think in the medical field, they're finding that it's a very helpful tool for diagnosis. So there are ways that it will be useful for us. And I think the big parameter that we as people of faith need to put around that is, well, there's several things. One is it true? Is it giving us truth in the classical sense of what we mean by truth, that it conforms to what is real and what is actual?
Or what our senses are apprehending, right?
Mm-hmm.
It conforms to mm-hmm. what our senses are telling us.
And is it just?
Absolutely. You know, the whole thing about algorithms are put together and created by human beings. So, or at least at some stage, there's human beings involved in that programming. And their prejudices and biases, if they're not questioning themselves, are taken right into that. And if you've ever seen the film that's on Netflix, Coded Bias, by an MIT student who was doing facial recognition research. And she, as a Black woman, she was not being recognized. As soon as she put on a white mask, she was being recognized. So she, this film is really, it's an eye opener. And when she went to the companies after the film, where the film was made, and she had established that this was a problem, she went to Facebook, she went to Apple, she went to Microsoft. The only company that changed anything was IBM. They took her, her information, they studied it, and they changed their algorithms. But the others preferenced the white male, always, and whiteness over any other color. This gets into prejudice. It gets into an online version of redlining when it comes to, you know, drawing political districts. So it's highly problematic when it comes to justice and injustice and cementing structures of injustice that are going to be hard to undo once the algorithms are set.
Yes, I have a suspicion that the algorithms are set by our own human biases. And because, in particular, in the United States, we live in a culture that privileges whiteness, we can't often see that bias. And we are just exporting it into our newest technologies, right?
That's right. And some people are not doing it maliciously. It's because they don't even think about it. And those are your white male programmers who are the even though there are a lot of other people involved in programming, it's not completely a white male domain, but it is principally a white male domain.
Mm-hmm. This can all feel very overwhelming for someone who barely knows how to turn on their computer or use their email.
It can.
So what I'd like to do is go back to a phrase that you used early on, and that is media mindfulness. Being mindful is a practice that people of faith are comfortable with and used to. We are mindful about our relationships with other people. We're mindful when we are in worship. We try to look for the symbols that give our worship meaning and be attentive to those. How does that get translated to sitting in front of the television with your family to watch a movie?
That's a great question. And, you know, the answer is free. It's out there, and I can tell it to you right now, and you probably know it already. You know, the THINK, think. It's asking five simple questions. Is it true? Is it helpful? Is it inspiring? Is it necessary? And most of all, is it kind? That's all we have to ask ourselves before we post anything, before we create media. Respond. But then you come to the point, well, we're watching a movie with our family. Well, it still goes. At the end, was there kindness shown? Were there any moments of grace, of goodness between people, with people helping other people? Was the story itself worth our time? Was it just superfluous or just fun? You know, people, I want to talk about Barbie because I really liked Barbie, not because she was a doll or anything like that. But did you see it, Beth?
I have not seen it yet, if you can believe it.
Okay. So any movie that is predicated on the thought of dying is a movie worth watching. Because she asks her other Barbies early on in the movie, have you ever thought about dying? And they go, ooh, you can't talk about that. We're Barbies. You know, you can't think about things like that. But she does. And it's like, it's almost like the movie The Croods. I don't know if you saw that probably 10, 12 years ago, but it was when prehistoric man all of a sudden got consciousness and awareness. So in a way, it's Barbie is getting, she's going from being a cave woman, a very well-dressed, high-heeled cave woman, to having awareness and self-consciousness, self-awareness, and being mindful, if you will. So I think that Barbie was a great movie to ask yourself, is it true? Well, maybe it's partially factual because she's there, right? I mean, it's a phenomenon since 1959. March 9th, 1959 is when Barbie was born, or came into being. So yes, it's true. Is the story true? Well, you know, there's truth and there's fact.
Right? I love the saying that all stories are true and some of them really happen.
Yes, that was my friend, Sister Gretchen Heiler, who came up with that. Yeah, and so that's what this is. It's a true story that, and some of it happened. So, and then you can ask, is it helpful? Well, you know, if you watch the whole movie, I think it does help us reflect on the struggles of women and even men to some extent who are just meant to be accessories too. I mean, the objectification of any human being is wrong. So these are things we can talk about. So is it inspirational? Well, that would depend on the person, if it inspired you or not. I would say it energized me. So I would put an E in there and it got me very interested. So there's the I. Is it necessary? Because it's a reflection on our culture and a deeper reflection than what you might think, I think, sure, it's necessary. I think it was. And in fact, there's some parts in it I can't believe Mattel let go, because it's a real critique of Mattel and the toy consumeristic industry as a throwaway culture. It's there. And then is it kind? There's kindness, great kindness in it. So, yeah, so that T-H-I-N-K works pretty well with any type of media we might consume or think about creating.
That's interesting. You know, I've used that frequently when we think about what we're posting, but I have not thought about it as a tool to use while consuming media like movies or television or streaming programs.
Yeah.
So that's a wonderful thing. How does that mindfulness impact our personal faith development then? I'm thinking about my nieces who are now raising their own families and their concern for what their kids are consuming. Mm-hmm. They're very attentive to that. Mm-hmm. And when they're small, when they're preschoolers, you can control that kind of thing. But a moment is going to come when you're going to have to send those kids out into the world and you're going to lose control mm-hmm. of the media they consume. So I'm just wondering if you have any insights to share for, you know, parents of young kids as they're forming their children in an understanding of the impact of media on our lives.
Well, there's a couple of things. A great question. One of the first things is that parents have to talk to their kids from the day they bring them home from the hospital or the day they're born. And the children need to grow up in an environment where talking is normal, where their communication with their parents is normal. Because at the age of 10, it's going to be really hard for parents to say, let's sit down and have a chat. Parents also learn how to do it without being a formal chat, but to find out what is the reality of their children's inner life. And the only way to do that is to have a relationship with your child through communication. But remember, control, as you kind of alluded to, control only lasts for the moment. Communication lasts a lifetime. So if you built relationships based on communication, sharing thoughts, feelings, and motivating your decisions about media with your children, I think you have a much better chance at succeeding at knowing what their media lives are all about, because you can be sure that probably there's a good percentage already by the age of 10 that they're involved in that the parents don't know. So the parents, the time that you do have with your children, put your phones aside. Otherwise, they're just going to imitate you. You're standing there on your phone while you're taking a walk in the park, or, you know, while they're playing in the park, they're just going to want to do what you do. That's what kids do. They imitate adults or older kids. So it's up to us to give the good example too.
We are speaking really from a place of privilege where we have all the technology that we need in order to live our lives. But what happens, and we saw this during the pandemic, I think, school districts had to really scramble to provide the tools that the children in the inner city schools and those with less financial resources had in order to keep their children engaged in learning. And we know that it didn't work, that children have fallen behind as a result of that pandemic. So do we have a responsibility as a society to pay attention to those kinds of divides?
Oh, of course, because of the lack of access leaves people out of the conversation. It creates two different or multiple societies or levels of society, shall we say. So social strata, it's a big problem. I know in Los Angeles Unified School District, it took them a while, but there were 25,000 kids or some huge number of kids that would use their parents' phone when they got home from work during COVID because their parents were in the service industries. So they worked. And the only access they had to do homework was their parents' phone. And if there were two or three kids in the family or more, what were they supposed to do? It took them a long time to get iPads.
Oh, hi, Sister Beth. I heard you coming down the hall. What are you humming?
Hi, Jean Ann. That's a song from evening prayer yesterday. I can't get it out of my head.
What is it?
It's called Song of Mary. Dan Schutte wrote it. We use it sometimes at evening prayer, and every single time it stays in my head for at least a day. It's a good thing I like it.
Hey, do you think our Floodcast listeners have favorite hymns like that?
I bet they do. What are you thinking?
How about a special episode of Floodcast dedicated to our listeners' favorites?
I think that's a great idea. Let's do it.
Okay. How about I leave instructions for everyone at flowcastlisten.org and post them on our social media accounts? That way, everyone will know what to do.
That sounds great, Jean Ann. But to get people started sooner, our listeners can call us and leave a voicemail message telling us the name of their favorite hymn and what they like about it. We may use the recording of their voice in our show. So the number they can call to leave that message is area code 217-321-7939. I'll say it again. It's area code 217-321-7939.
So that is where our guests can call you to tell you about their favorite hymn?
Yes, that's right, Jean Ann. And if they want more detail, they can visit page you're going to set up at flowcastlisten.org, where they will find everything they need to know. They can also search for at flowcastlisten, and our social media accounts will come up. And I think you said you'd put the information there too, right?
Yes.
Okay, now we need our guests to hurry and do that because we'd like to launch the special hymn episode of Flowcast early in December. So I think that means we need to hear from them by November 1st. Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
Because we have to know the source of the knowledge that we're consuming in order to be able to be good judges of it, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of where you and I started 30 years ago was, yes. You know, consuming news and what does it mean to understand bias and perspective and the impact of the news production system on what you receive on the other end of it all.
The ideology behind the whole business, that's what we forget sometimes is that media is a commercial enterprise with profit interests. Even the nonprofits have to make a profit to live and exist. But it's the solely profit-driven that is the most problematic because that's when ethics normally go out the window.
They can. The ethics can go out the window, certainly. The analogy that I often use is to talk about the Roman roads. And I think while Pope Francis doesn't use this exact image, I've heard him say similar things. The early Christians could not have spread the gospel without the existence of the infrastructure of the Roman highway system.
Yeah.
And that's more or less the what we're facing today, correct?
Yes, that absolutely.
We need to use the infrastructure created by these for-profit businesses that have a different reason for being than we do in order to preach the gospel.
That's right.
And that's the challenge that we face. So we need to do so being as gentle as doves and as wise as serpents, as Jesus said to us.
And being, if we're not present in these various spaces, we don't exist in those spaces. You know, whether it's from Instagram to TikTok to, you know, YouTube, all of these spaces, it's like television before. I remember Cardinal Foley of the Pontifical Council for Social Communication that is now the Dicastery for Communication. And I remember him saying that if the church is not on television, the church does not exist. Because it's not in the awareness of people. It's not there in front of them like everything else is. You know, oh gosh. Yeah, it's a big world and there's so many opportunities to be present, to be influencers, right? You don't just have to have your own YouTube channel to be an influencer, right?
Say more about that.
Well, I think anybody who's involved in evangelization like we are, in whatever form that takes, whether it's witness, education, healthcare, communications, service to the poor, life, all of these various apostolates and ways of preaching the gospel, of bringing Christ to the world today and making Christ incarnate in the world today is a way we've influenced. But now these opportunities to speed it up and to be present in more spaces and in front of more eyeballs is all there for us, for the taking and for the giving. The opportunities are there, and I think it behooves us. I was in a country in Europe a few months ago that had been under communism until 30 years ago when the curtain came down. And I have to tell you, I was surprised that they didn't feel the urgency that I feel of being present online, of being, you know, it was, or even to have a policy in the community of what our use is. And it's not an imposed policy. It's more of a policy that is motivated by our life and our work, our lifestyle, our pace of life. And it was, I remember one sister saying to me, "I really don't know what you're talking about." And this was not a cloistered nun. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, my goodness, she does spiritual direction, but I'm surprised that even that has not come up in her spiritual direction with people, because we are certainly involved in media everywhere we turn. The fact is that we still come in contact with something like 30,000, is it 30,000 discrete messages every day? If we're out riding in our car, whatever we do, if we spend it online, we are constantly seeing messages and advertising coming to us. So how do we navigate that? And we're not even aware of it.
Well, and how does someone who grew up in an oppressive regime understand the use of media? It's going to be very different for her than it is for us.
Propaganda was always mm-hmm. propaganda, but in a way they took it as a grain of salt because they knew it was propaganda. They knew that they were being lied to for the most part. Mm-hmm. So, but not to see the commercialization that's happening, even though it's maybe not to the extent of the United States, it's certainly there. Mm-hmm. So I had a little bit of a learning curve there. mm-hmm. and even how I present it.
Sure. So the goal is to help, and I'm presuming this was a part of your effort on behalf of the congregation to...
To look at how do we live religious life in a digital age? Mm-hmm. How do we evangelize in a digital age? How do we minister to youth in a digital age? You know, what does it mean for ourselves personally? What does it mean for our communities? And what does it mean for the people of God? Mm-hmm. And I always bring up the idea of planning. You know, a goal without a plan is just a wish. And that goes for families too. Well, I want my kids, you know, not to be on their phones all day. So what's the plan? How are you going to do that? How are you going to say that we're going to use our phones for a half hour in the evening, you know? And that's when you get your homework done. You know, mm-hmm. that's when your homework's done. And if you haven't behaved well, or you haven't done your chores or whatever that, you know, the family's lifestyle is, you lose your privilege that night. Mm-hmm. You know, but parents have to be willing to lose their privileges too. Right?
Sure. To set the example.
They can close the door when they go to bed, but what if the kids comes in and needs something and sees both parents there laying in bed with each with their own phone? This is not going to give a good message.
This is true. You know what? We're coming to the end of our time together, and I'd like to end with something that is inspiring. And we all have those moments when a song or a book or a movie that we've seen has made the difference in our lives. So what would that be for you?
Oh, I mean, I can go back to, you know, when I was a teenager before I entered the convent, and I remember what the world needs now is love, sweet love, not just love for one, but for everyone. And it was during the buildup of the Vietnam War, and it just seemed like, I remember we were gathering as Girl Scouts and we were talking about that song. But this is before I really had a realization, or even before I met our sisters. I didn't even know that we worked in media. But certainly there's so many songs, and music is such a direct way to touch our hearts. But if I had to speak of films, The Lives of Others, the German film, is a film that I found superbly human and heroic and kind and forgiving. It was about the Stasi agent who reported on a pianist, an artist. And can a truly good man, can a bad man truly make such beautiful art? It has to be a good man who makes this art. Just a table the other night here in Boston, where we have so many sisters, we were talking about The Devil Wears Prada, and we were explaining it to one of our sisters from Romania who speaks English really well. She's just here to polish up her English, and she hadn't seen it. So there's three or four of us telling the story at the same time, and how at the end, the Anne Hathaway character chooses to be a decent human being and not give her life up to consumption and consumerism and to not caring about other people the way the Meryl Streep's character does. And isn't that a great lesson in the midst of materialism and everything, that you can still choose to be a decent human being?
Yes. I think about the polar opposites. I'm right there with you on Of Gods and Men. I watch it every year. I make sure I see it once a year. It's an incredible film. And I love The Devil Wears Prada. And both of those movies can bring you to an inner reflection on your faith, on your values, and with just a little prodding, sitting with your children while you're watching any kind of the film that they like to see, any one of their favorite films, for parents to just point out, that character did a good thing. You know, it doesn't take that much. Your reflection on what you watch together as a family, or you're questioning a child maybe about a film that they've gone to see without you. Well, what did you learn from that film? Mm-hmm. You know, do you think that's a lesson that you want to live out? What does it jive with your own values? those very simple questions can begin to shape how we consume media and whether we become better humans or not because of it. So I don't think we could think of a more wonderful thing than that. I'll be sure to share all the movies you mentioned and your favorite song. I'll be putting all those in the show notes that go with this podcast. Rose, it has just been a joy to catch up with you. We should do this more often. When's the next time you're coming to Illinois or St. Louis?
Well, I'll be in St. Louis in October. I'll see you then, right?
Oh, that's right. We're going to be at the conference together. We'll be at the Communicators for Women Religious meeting in October. That will be wonderful to see you there.
Yes.
I'll look very much forward to it.
Me too.
Thank you, Sister Rose Picotti, my dear friend and co-conspirator when it comes to all things Catholic in media. This has been Flowcast. The Flow in Flowcast stands for the life of the world, a reminder that all of us are to be imitators of Jesus Christ, who gave his life for the life of the world. A big thanks to my Flowcast team, Brandon Durham, our engineer, and our marketing guru and guest wrangler, Jean Ann Miller. The two of them, along with me, Sister Beth Murphy, are so grateful to be able to have Sister Rose with us and to share our love of media with our guests. Until next time.